We continue our look at the defeat of Eric Cantor this past week in the Virginia GOP primary by zooming in on the issue that most agree was the foundation for the win by David Brott. As immigration reform has been talked about and promoted in various ways by leaders of both parties, voters have been seeing scenes of thousands of illegal immigrants recently gathering at the border. That image, most say, added to the defeat of Cantor. Here to discuss what those two elements mean for immigration reform, from The Nation, it's George Zornig. Good morning, George.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to have you back here. TheNation.com on the web. You learn more, read more about George's work and the other journalists with The Nation. And, well, like I said in the introduction, too, was you had Brett, some say wisely, hammering Eric Cantor, probably not so much on being a proponent of amnesty, but maybe more so playing into the Virginia 7 voters' belief that Cantor wasn't doing enough against the idea of any sort of reform. And you combine that with the visual that's probably seen on places like Fox News, and I know Drudge Report has put a lot of still photos on. Was that the 1-2 punch that Brott needed to knock out Cantor?
Yeah, you know, it was kind of a perfect storm for Cantor. He is, to be clear, against immigration reform, but his one sort of foray in that direction was to, last year, repeatedly talk up this idea of the Kids Act, which was basically the Republican idea of the Dream Act. And that would, of course, give youth who were brought to this country by their parents when they were very young a shot at citizenship. And those talks fell apart. There was a debate over, you know, in the Democratic version, once those kids become citizens, they can then sponsor their parents. And there was a lot of infighting in the Republican Party over whether that would happen with the Kids Act, and eventually it fell apart. But that was Cantor's sort of big mark in the debate. And so at the very same time that this election is happening, as you mentioned, there's this child refugee crisis on the border. Now, a lot of that is being driven by internal politics and dynamics in Central America, where there's rapidly increasing violence, and parents are sending their kids northward. The U.S. economy is looking a little better, so it's a more attractive destination. So you have these tens of thousands of kids lining up on the border and basically in refugee camps and U.S. military bases, which, as you mentioned, is a huge story in the right-wing media. I mean, you see some stuff about it in the New York Times and on the local news, network news, but huge story in the right-wing media. And so Brad has been very aggressively tying Cantor to this and actually saying, with basically no evidence, but that these kids were racing up here for Eric Cantor's amnesty, that because Eric Cantor had agreed to this or had at least talked about this idea of giving undocumented youth citizenship, that that's why there were all these kids left at the border. So it was kind of this perfect storm. The one thing he advocated happened to line up with a real-life story right at election time, and no doubt it contributed to his loss.
How much of this is a lesson for politicians on a district level to, before you take a stand on a national issue, get a better understanding of what the people in your backyard are thinking?
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of a broader, you know, there's no one reason why Cantor lost. And sort of the context of all of this is that, yeah, Cantor just was not in touch with his district in most ways. I mean, if you read a lot of local accounts and interviews with people down there, I mean, they rarely saw him in the district. When they did, he was kind of hot-shotting around with a big security entourage, even if he's in a little coffee shop when he's got all the security with him. And he was perceived very much as not being into it on immigration, on a number of other issues, and just in general not really caring about the district, about caring more about, you know, the perception was that he really was focused on becoming House Speaker and sort of the internal leadership politics in D.C. and going on Fox News. And as far as the 7th District goes, he just didn't really care. And I think, frankly, that was a pretty accurate perception.
So that's also a lesson for politicians who seek to be power brokers, that if you want to lead an organization or party leadership, do it in an organization rather than run for office, ignore the people who got you there, and work on a national level, you know, like we saw Cantor do through he had to do fundraising and speech and show support for candidates around the country, much like we're seeing a Chris Christie do now too, where some say he's ignoring many of his duties in New Jersey because he's doing all this work for the Republican Governors Association.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the day before Cantor lost, he was up in Long Island. He wasn't in his district. He was up in Long Island stumping for this kind of no-name Republican candidate out there. And you know, that just fits in with the perception that he was much more interested in national politics and less about what was going on back home.
Talking with George Zornig from The Nation, TheNation.com, the web, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. You mentioned, too, about the disconnect that and the lack of attention that Cantor paid to his district, and it wasn't a big secret. It's been long talked about, and yet you always had, when he was in office still, Ron Paul was always more a national politician and personality than he was a district public servant, and yet he always seemed to get reelected and never had a problem. And what would you think would be the difference? What was Ron Paul doing that was right that Eric Cantor did that was wrong?
Well, at least in that case, Ron Paul might have been more ideologically in step with his district. I think yet another problem that Cantor faced was that he sort of set himself up as the hero of the conservative vanguard. He was the one pushing Boehner to be more aggressive, to listen more to the Tea Party. He was the one who really almost single-handedly forced that debt ceiling showdown back in 2011. And that's actually a very dangerous position to put yourself in, because if you set yourself up as a leader of the conservative vanguard and you're in a backbench, you can just vote no on everything all the time. But if you're in Cantor's position, at some point or another, you finally do have to come around. And he finally did approve debt ceiling increases. He finally did agree to budget deals. And that was something that Brad also wielded very strongly against him. So, you know, you're taking, in a way, it's sort of like becoming the head of the mob. I mean, you're putting a big old target on your back by you know, standing up and trying to lead this sort of conservative rebellion in the House, and that's exactly what happened to Cantor.
And looking at Cantor's ads too, and well, first of all, he outspent his opponent 26 to 1. I think it was like $5 million versus $175,000. And Cantor's ads were trying to hammer Bratt as a liberal college professor. One small problem with that, any time that Bratt got up, again, he would talk about against immigration reform, and he was a free market proponent. So, you know, if someone just listened to David Bratt talk, where would you get the idea he was a liberal out of anything?
Well, you know, it's interesting. David Bratt did, and he's by no means a liberal, but his sort of overarching critique of Eric Cantor was not only was he concerned very much with Washington power politics, but also that he was a close ally of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and of Wall Street. And so that's the kind of stuff, in general, that you hear from folks like Elizabeth Warren. Now, Dave Bratt has very different remedies for this problem, but he is a guy who talks in conservative terms about the poisonous influence of big corporations, the Chamber of Commerce, and the immigration critiques sort of fit into there. He didn't come at it as in a way that a lot of folks like Tom Tancredo or Steve King come at it from a kind of xenophobic and anti-Latin perspective on immigration. He attacked Cantor as, here's this guy who's a friend of big business, and he wants to bring immigrants into this country to depress wages, to help out his buddies in the business sector so that they can pay even fewer wages, you know, pay lower wages to immigrants as opposed to Americans. So it all sort of fit into this big overarching critique.
Wrapping up our time with George Zornick from The Nation, thenation.com, and the web here on Issues and Ideas. It's kind of obvious to say what a Republican would do right now, given the Bratt win and Cantor loss regarding any kind of idea of talk of immigration reform. But Republican in the red state, I should say, what about a Democrat in a purple state? What position are they in right now when this topic comes up?
You know, I think they may also be a little bit scared by it and take the lesson that immigration reform is a very dangerous thing to back. Though I will say, if you look at the polls in Cantor's district, even Republicans narrowly favor the comprehensive reform that was passed by the Senate. Overall, if you look at Democrats, independents, and Republicans, it was overwhelmingly favored. The problem is that the folks who are against it are highly, highly motivated. And the folks who are for it are, you know, kind of for it. It's a low-level issue for them. So it's more a matter of overcoming small but very well organized and very fired up opposition. So I think they'll be looking at it, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they won't back it, but they have to figure out a way to at least sort of take a clear position and fire up the other side. There's one argument that I'm not sure I agree with, but it's that Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, who basically helped craft this Senate bill on immigration, he won his primary in South Carolina the same day. And some folks say, well, that's because he sort of didn't run away from it, and he got people on board, and, you know, Cantor was very back and forth. He seemed to try to have it all ways on immigration. And so the lesson maybe is you just go all in on it. You just say, I'm for it, and this is why. Now, I'm not sure I totally agree with that. I think the dynamics in South Carolina were just much different than Cantor's district. But,
well, yeah, Graham had a more of a loose cannon opponent, too. David Bratt was a lot more refined than whoever Graham's opponent was.
Right. The number two in South Carolina was this kind of wacky guy. I mean, he was in the state assembly, but he was this guy who thought that South Carolina should mint its own currency and stop the dollar. And, you know, he compared the IRS to Hitler's brown shirts. I mean, he was not he he was not a well-organized and polished candidate like Dave Brat was.
Learn more about this issue and read the work of George Zornick and the rest of the journalists at The Nation. Obvious places, thenation.com. George, thanks for being here this morning.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.